Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good Monday morning, everybody. And today on our program, when Pope Francis said last week that the Catholic Church has been obsessed with contraception, abortion, and homosexuality, was he saying something really new? Well, according to New York's Cardinal Dolan, maybe not so much. Maybe it's just strategy.
If the church comes off as a scold, it's counterproductive. If the church comes off as a loving, inviting, embracing mother, who periodically has to correct her children, but who first and foremost loves and embraces them, then we're going to be effective.
So maybe the patriarchal church is becoming the matriarchal church. That was from a Cardinal Dolan news conference yesterday. But Catholic listeners, what did you hear in church yesterday after the Pope made all those waves? What did you hear from the pulpit? What was the buzz in the congregation? We'll take your calls on this later in the program, but you can tweet us right now at Brian Lehrer to get this going, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. What did you hear in church about Pope Francis's possible reset on sexuality and his emphasis on poverty? Tweet at Brian Lehrer, post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll talk about that later in the program with your calls. Also today, we begin our election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. It's Education Week to kick off 30 Issues this year. Our first guest will be Diane Ravitch, the outspoken critic of Common Core standards, as well as standardized testing. And we have environmentalist Bill McKibben on the show today. But we begin with the drama about to take place here in New York this week at the United Nations, with the possibility of a new diplomatic opening between the United States and Iran, the delicate U.S.-Russia diplomacy in the Security Council still over a Syria resolution, and the unity on the Council over the terrorist mall attack in Kenya, which is still not entirely over. With us is David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent and author of Confront and Conceal, President Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David has also reported extensively on U.S.-Iran relations, apparently front and center right now. Good morning, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Morning, Brian. Great to be back with you.
So the big news at the United Nations session beginning today was going to be about Syria and Iran. Will it now also be about Kenya and Somalia and al-Shabaab and al-Qaeda?
It may be a bit, but my guess is that since the UN is a place about diplomacy and suddenly diplomacy is at front and center, as sort of a big surprise when it comes to both disarming Syria and now getting the first real discussions with Iran going on the nuclear program in many, many years, I suspect that that will really be the focus. And the al-Shabaab attack in Kenya is not something that the UN can do much about other than condemn. And it will be up to the U.S., the African Union, and many others to go figure out whether this group that they've had on the run in Somalia is now turning out to be significantly more resilient than they thought over the border in Kenya.
Does al-Shabaab come up in your book about President Obama's surprising use of American power?
Only in to the degree that you have seen the president recognize over the 5 years he's been in place that while al-Qaeda Central got pretty well defeated even before bin Laden was killed, the al-Qaeda affiliates, Yemen, Somalia, and so forth and so on, are in some ways the much more potent problem right now. But there's a question about whether or not they are a threat to the United States or whether they are just a regional threat. They are certainly a terrorist group, but then the question comes, how much effort do you put into going after a terror group that is not primarily aimed at the U.S., the way al-Qaeda Central was?
Or are they? The Times article today on the mall attack, or one of the articles, makes it seem like the United States was an indirect target for
American
having—
American citizens were.
Well—
you're right, and non-Muslims in the And, of course, this mall seems, you know, like the Americanized corner in Nairobi.
So there's that. And in addition, having a strong CIA presence in Kenya and other involvement with Kenyan security and then Kenya getting involved in fighting al-Shabaab in Somalia. To the question you were posing before, we have to wonder, is that about American involvement in their regional war, or is it about some other agenda against the United States in a bigger way, like Osama bin Laden?
That's right. And do they have the reach to get to the United States the way bin Laden did on 9/11? And you know, that's always the fear. And you know, the hard question in counterterrorism these days is, how much effort do you put into regional uprisings? And they are all over the world, from, you know, the Philippines, as we've seen in recent days, to Northern Africa, to all of the rest of these regions. And how much do you focus on those threats that are actually direct threats to the United States? Because not every one of these groups has the reach that bin Laden did. But if you ignore it for too long, they can develop that reach.
And Congressman Peter King on ABC This Week yesterday made a point of saying that there are about 30 known American citizens among the al-Shabaab fighters in Somalia. He didn't say involved with this attack, but involved with the group. And he worried about the homeland security implications if some of those Americans were to return here. Do you know anything about these Americans, like if they are of Somali descent or if there's any reason to believe that they might have any interest in coming home and staging an al-Shabaab-linked attack here?
You know, I don't. I heard him say that. I couldn't tell whether those were 30 committed members or 30 people who were sort of suspected of being part of it. But, you know, you've got to compare that number, large as it may sound, to the number of people who are suspected at any moment who are already in the United States as potential domestic terrorists. Think of the acts of internal terrorism we've seen over the past few years, and think, you know, it was just a week ago today that we saw that horrific shooting in the Naval Yard here in Washington.
Right.
Not an act of terrorism in the organized sense, seemed to be the act of somebody who was having a number of mental illness issues, but certainly the kind of act that you worry the most about. And the question is, where do you put your effort? If you've got limited resources, do you worry about the 30 who are in Somalia and Kenya? Do you worry more about filtering people here in the United States? Because you can't turn the entire country into a complete surveillance state, as we've debated at other times.
Before we turn the page and go on to some of the other things that we said we talk about, has President Obama drawn any red lines on Kenya or Somalia?
He has not, not that I've heard. He has made it clear through the drone attacks that he is willing to go use American power in places beyond the territories of Pakistan. There have been drone attacks in Yemen. There have been a few in Somalia. There have been scattered ones elsewhere. I think this weekend was the 400th drone attack under the Obama administration, roughly. We don't have precise numbers on them, but as well as people can keep track. Do you have any idea, Brian, how many drone attacks there were
under
during
Bush,
the entire Bush administration?
I was just going to ask you. Okay,
48.
Yeah.
48.
Compared to 400.
Yep.
So, right. Well, he's going for small targeted strikes instead of big invade a country wars, and
that's the light footprint strategy that I described at some length in Confront and Conceal. And the question is this a strategy that now is beginning to run out of gas, because there are a lot of places, including Syria, where it's not especially useful?
But do we use the drone attacks just to go after terrorists in those places who are considered potential threats to the United States, or also, say, to help the Somali and Kenyan governments keep al-Shabaab at bay for their domestic purposes?
the theory is that you're doing both, that by keeping them at bay, you are keeping them from exploiting a vacuum in power, less in Kenya than in a place like Somalia, where there's been, you know, basically no real working government until recent times. And there the issue is, can you then help the non-existent government, but also keep Somalia from becoming the next Northwest Territory in Pakistan?
David Sanger with us, New York Times chief Washington correspondent and author of Confront and Conceal, President Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. And listeners, we're going to talk about Iran and Syria and the UN session and the possible diplomatic breakthroughs now. If you want to call in about those things, you can. If you want to call in about Kenya and Somalia, you can. Some of our Kenyan and Somalian listeners, your calls are always welcome. Or anyone else, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for David Sanger this morning. And so, is President Obama meeting with Iran's new leader, President Rouhani? That seems to be one of the big questions right now. No U.S. president has met with an Iranian head of state since Carter and the Shah in 1977. If I have my history right, the Shah was the last ally of the U.S. to head Iran. Here is White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes on this question of a meeting over the weekend.
We don't have a meeting scheduled with President Rouhani, but we're always open to diplomacy if we believe it can advance our objectives. And in this instance, our objective is an Iran that meets its international obligations.
So, David Sanger, as he keeps the door open there, is this speculated about meeting on?
Well, the speculation is that they will find a way to run into each other, not to do anything substantive. That may come on Thursday when you're going to see both the Iranian foreign minister and Secretary of State John Kerry in the same session of the of what's known as the in the awful diplo speak as the P5 plus one, but basically the U.S. and some of its European allies, the Russians and the Chinese, meeting with Iran. But that will put the Secretary of State in a Iranian foreign minister in the same room for the first time in a while. As for President Obama and President Rouhani, I hear the same thing from the Iranians that you just heard from Mr. Rhodes, and I assume that to mean that they're trying some kind of chance meeting. You know, when the president's coming back from a run and stops into Starbucks on Third Avenue, and there's President Rouhani having a latte. I mean, I don't know. They'll probably run into each other in the corridor.
The highly orchestrated chance encounter.
That's right.
And here is President Rouhani on this same question over the weekend in Iran. We will translate this afterwards, but since we have this clip, we thought we would play it for everybody. Here, folks, is your 23 seconds of untranslated Farsi for the day.
ملت ایران با غرب آماده مذاکره و سخن گفتن است به شرط آن که پیش شرطی نباشد از موضع برابر باشد با احترام متقابل باشد.
So for those of you non-Farsi speakers who just like to listen to cadence and tone of voice and try to take things from those, there you are. He was speaking at a military parade, and it had that kind of echoey sound over the weekend. And the translation that I have is that he said the Iranian nation is ready to talk and negotiate with the West, provided there are no preconditions, that the talks are on equal steps, and there is mutual respect. So, David Sanger, how do you parse that language, assuming the translation is correct?
Well, assuming the translation is correct, and my Farsi is non-existent, that is very close, the no preconditions and mutual respect, to the kinds of things that President Obama was saying during the 2008 campaign. And you'll remember that among those he was criticized for saying that was Hillary Rodham Clinton, who then had to go execute the policy. Pardon me. But I don't see anything in that setup that would preclude Iran and the U.S. from sitting down. Now, sitting down is a very different thing from getting to an agreement. And the situation is quite different from when we all knew Mr. Rouhani as the nuclear negotiator nearly a decade ago. back then, Iran had 164 centrifuges that they were building in one site. Today, they have 18,000. Not all of them are running. That gives them the ability to produce and enrich uranium at a rate that many in the U.S. intelligence agencies fear that if all 18,000 were running, they could get fairly quickly to what's called breakout. In other words, move from low-enriched to high-enriched uranium at such a high speed that the U.S. intelligence agencies may not pick it up until it was too late. So I think one of the questions is, can the United States get off of its position, which is not one centrifuge spins? Can the Iranians agree to begin to dismantle some of what they have built? And so that you ended up with a nascent but small enrichment capability in Iran, one that kept the Iranians feeling as if they have the right to enrich, but one in which the Americans think they would have enough warning if there was ever a race for a bomb.
You described in your article the other day Rouhani's position as looking to save face at home by producing a small amount of nuclear fuel, but at the same time allaying fears in the U.S. and Israel that it's racing for a bomb. So if that turns out to be where he's really at, why that change? I mean, that's pretty different from Ahmadinejad, the previous president, or the mullahs who were supposedly still in charge, no matter what Rouhani says.
Well, number one, we don't know what the mullahs would do with a deal once they saw one. There was a tentative, smaller deal put together in 2009, you may recall, that when it went back to Tehran, the supreme leader rejected. And so there's always the possibility that the negotiators are going to be out there, they're going to do their best, they're going to go back to Tehran, and then the supreme leader is going to make his judgment. Now, Rouhani says he has full authority to negotiate, and I'm sure that will be his message as he speaks to many more people in New York this week. And he's becoming like the hottest ticket. You think the Emmys were hard yesterday, right? So, you know, he's going to be on CNN. I think Charlie Rose is interviewing him. He's speaking to a number of journalists. He is speaking at an event at the Council on Foreign Relations and the Asia Society on Thursday. That's going to be a mix of journalists, foreign policy professionals, academics. So they're out here in full court press.
Fascinating. We'll get to find out how good Charlie Rose's Farsi is, I guess.
That's right.
Or is Rouhani a fluent English speaker?
He understands some, but I don't know that I have ever heard him speak it, which doesn't mean he can't.
You don't think these are going to be sit down, all these appearances that you're talking about, in English conversations? Like, I think a lot of people were surprised when Charlie Rose got Assad the other week, and Assad was just, you know, speaking there in English. People don't realize that this is the younger Assad who's got more connections with the West, though his policies don't seem to, you know, to reveal that. You don't think Rouhani's going to sit down and have English language conversations with all these folks?
I doubt he will for two reasons. One is, when you're dealing with something as precise as these kind of negotiations, you don't want to be outside of your native tongue. I mean, when I was a foreign correspondent, I was in Japan, and my Japanese was notoriously bad, but I understood just enough to be dangerous, and, you know, I would not want to go rely on my own translation. There's a second thing, too. Remember that line about mutual respect. And I suspect that back home, Rouhani wants to be seen speaking in Farsi to the President of the United States, not going over to the President's own language. Mm.
David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent and author of Confront and Conceal, President Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, as we talk about the UN session this week, Iran, we'll get to Syria, as well as what happened in Kenya over the weekend. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post a comment or question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Amir in the Bronx, thank you for calling in. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Brian. My question is this larger question of not coming to grips with reality, but the 2 billion Muslims exist. They have a life. They religion is represented by the teachings of the Quran, God's last revelation. So just can we supported the Kenyan army going into Somalia, raping, killing, pillaging left and right into villages, burning down villages. Where was Obama and the rest when all this was happening? And now that the Somalis are retaliating, we see it all in the news, all this nonsense about Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab. Well, when can we put an end to this nonsense? I mean, you know, you represent the voice of the world, Brian. Why don't you take the leap of faith, have the courage to come out and speak for the Muslim, not against the Muslims?
Well, if you think that speaking for the Muslims means condoning an attack on a shopping mall, I'm not sure that a lot of people consider that speaking for the Muslims. But on the question of U.S. foreign policy, David Sanger, that he raises, have you reported on this or followed it enough to know that if he characterizes it accurately as Kenyan troops going in to Somalia and raping and pillaging, as opposed to some other context?
Well, the Kenyan troops that are in Somalia, and there are a lot of troops that are in Somalia. Most of them are there in either a UN guise or in some cases coming in from their own countries. And there have been abuses all throughout. It's mostly been, most of the abuses you read about throughout the region, and I'm not speaking specifically to Somalia, have been Muslim-on-Muslim violence, which is hard to understand as well in these terms. But I think you have to separate out the civil war aspects of these different conflicts. Think about Syria, where it's a fight between two very different Muslim groups, obviously the Alawite minority and all of the other religious groups, including the Sunnis that are, occupy vast parts of Syria, and the question of what's in American interests and where the United States should enter. And this gets to a bigger question of humanitarian intervention. Does the U.S. get into every war? No. Are we in freeing the people who are in North Korean gulags? No. Is that any less of a human rights violation? And you could go anywhere else around the world than what we're seeing? Of course not. But when the president's got to decide on interventions, he's got to decide on it in terms of American national interests. And frequently that means, even if it sounds selfish, looking at the question of which of these groups can strike at core American interests and the homeland of the United States.
But it also, to give the caller some due, goes to a question of whether groups like Al-Qaeda spring out of whole cloth, out of sheer religious zealotry, as some people inaccurately, I think, try to portray, or if they become so zealous and tie their religion to it because of oppression and conditions that play into a horrific discontent. I happen to be reading a novel by Peter Akinti called The Forest Gate, largely about a Somali immigrant to London and how absolutely horrible the conditions were back in Somalia.
Absolutely. And, you know, that gets to the question of, first, how much nation building the United States should be doing to try to help improve those conditions and not have the conditions that give rise to Al-Qaeda affiliate groups. And that debate occupied the United States quite dramatically from 9/11 forward with, you know, as the outcome of the question, you know, why do they hate us? And the question of could we be doing more in those groups? And then the discovery in Afghanistan and Iraq that over time, while many of the U.S. efforts were appreciated, many more over time become resented. And the presence of Americans becomes resented. And I think that was sort of the failure of the Bush approach of going in and using the U.S. military for a nation-building purpose.
Elizabeth in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with David Sanger. Hi, Elizabeth.
Yeah, hi. I'm aware that the Bush administration in particular loved to talk about the president of Iran as an absolute dictator like Saddam Hussein, but he's not. The supreme leader is the supreme leader, the Grand Ayatollah. And the Ayatollah has made statements numerous times over the years saying nuclear weapons are un-Islamic, And that is why we will never have nuclear weapons.
And I think he's made statements contradictory of that also and been kind of hard to read in this respect. But David Sanger, what do you know?
Well, the Supreme Leader has, by and large, said, and he said it again over the past week, that nuclear weapons are un-Islamic. And he's also made the argument that even if they weren't in the strategic interests of Iran, that Iran could at best build a couple up against countries like the United States and Israel that have hundreds in Israel's case, thousands in the United States' case. So in other words, if there was an arms race, they wouldn't win it. All of that is true. The question is, do you go by what leaders of countries say or what you believe leaders of countries are doing? And one of the most notable elements of the UN inspection process in Iran is that the Iranians have refused to answer almost all of the questions about evidence of weaponization. And I've written about this, and many others have written about this at great length. There is non-conclusive evidence that Iranian scientists were working on technologies that can only be explained if you're trying to build a bomb and can't be explained if you're trying to build nuclear power plants. Things like hemispheres of nuclear fuel that would come together in a certain way to detonate an explosion, heights at which these explosions would happen, triggering devices, so forth and so on. And one of the things that's going to have to get cleared up in the next few months, if this negotiation goes forward, is whether or not the Iranians will have to go answer the international inspector's questions about that work and make those scientists, led by a man named Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, available for interviews, which they have never done.
Jonathan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jonathan.
Here I am.
Jonathan, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I just want to say a couple of things. I think there should be no diplomacy with Iran, and we should not support anyone that's associated with terrorists, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, the new one in Kenya now. And I say absolutely not, and the president should be ashamed of himself if he doesn't meet with him.
Why? Tell us why, Jonathan. You want to say why? You want to go a step further?
The American system is based on freedom, and liberty. And I think that there are certain people that want to destroy this whole country and bring it down.
But if Iran is willing to make some kind of a deal to end the nuclear program, which is the biggest threat to freedom that is seen with respect to Iran, both in the region and potentially here, if they're willing to make some deal to sort of rejoin the world because the sanctions are really starting to bite, or this new generation, maybe like a Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, if that analogy holds, just sees his country on the wrong path, why not negotiate?
Why not negotiate? Because for the past 40 years, we've been, since the fall of Iran and, the Shah over there, we've been negotiating. We've been very patient. And we're letting the world sit by and watch countries that want to annihilate any mode of freedom that's left. America is the only place where there's freedom, especially the Jewish people, where they've been banned from every single country in the world, cannot go back. The only thing that's left is synagogues. And same thing with churches. There's no churches almost left in Egypt. Same thing, you go there, it's a ghost town. Same thing is coming to America, but people don't see it. Just like in England, just like in the European countries, absolutely not.
All right. Thank you for your call. How strongly do you think that view is held in Israel, in particular, right now, with respect to negotiating with Iran? David, you've reported extensively on Israel, which Jonathan referenced. Do you think that that Israel and Netanyahu see this as an opportunity or a danger to get, of Obama getting hoodwinked?
Well, I think Netanyahu very clearly views this as a danger that Obama would get hoodwinked, that in his mind, and I'm not sure he's wrong here, that the strategy of the Iranians is negotiate, keep the discussions going, and meanwhile keep the centrifuges spinning and build more of them. And get closer to the point where they would have a nuclear capability, if not necessarily a weapon. And I personally, after years of working on this, I'm not persuaded the Iranians want a weapon as much as they want the capability to go build one. But to your caller's point, and the purpose of diplomacy is to try to take countries with whom you may not agree, don't agree, and with whom you may not share values and usually don't take share values, and through some process of enticement and coercion, bring them around to a position that you can live with and that you think ensures your own security. And you know, one of the issues with Iran is we haven't had real conversations with the Iranians in 30 years.
And we have to pretty much leave it there. I want to get 30 seconds from you on one other thing, because Iran and Syria are very tight allies. As you know, Syria is almost a client state of Iran, I think it's fair to say. So does the Syrian chemical weapons crisis and all the diplomacy around that recently affect this possible new opening with Iran one way or the other?
Definitely, and the question is which way. One theory is that if Assad falls, that the Iranians will feel more vulnerable because they will have lost their one great ally in the region and their conduit to Hezbollah for arms and so forth, and that that could lead them to race for a bomb. The other theory is that if, in fact, the disarming of Assad works, then the Iranians could come to the conclusion that there really is an international consensus against developing weapons of mass destruction, and they may feel all the more pressure to strike a deal. And the answer is, we just don't know which one of those two patterns of thinking or something in between is going to play out here.
David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent and author of Confront and Conceal, President Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. You know, I always think every September when the General Assembly comes to town and all these world leaders, what a fascinating, exciting time, and I think it always is. Unfortunately, on most New York radio, the UN General Assembly is treated first as a traffic story.
Well, it is, but Brian, I make the point that your studios are over on the west side, so you're going to be more insulated from this than the other half of Manhattan, and that's probably a happy thing for you.
I'll try to keep world peace and the traffic tie-ups in better perspective as I hang to the west side. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, Jonathan Chait from New York Magazine on his column that calls the effort to defund Obamacare an unprecedented act of sabotage. Stay with us.